Commissioner, please be seated. This case is Harrier's Operating Company versus the State of Nevada Department of Taxation, number 61521. Council ready to proceed?
Mr. Brown.
All right, Mr. Brown.
Good morning.
Good morning, how are you? This case is before this court on an appeal ultimately from the department's denial of two refund claims that were consolidated that were filed by Harrier's Operating Company. The refund claims are seeking a refund of lease taxes that Harrier's paid on their purchase of four jet aircraft that they purchased for the purpose of transporting corporate executives on their interstate and international business travels. And all four of that were purchased in 2006. Now, after the claims were denied, the case was submitted to the administrative law judge. We submitted the case on stipulated facts and documents and briefs, so we did not have an evidentiary hearing. So the facts were basically agreed to, which makes the issues in this case issues of law. The resolution of the issues in this case revolves around whether or not use tax is supposedly due on the purchase of these aircraft. And the statutes to be interpreted in this case are NRS 372-255 and NRS 372-258. Now, use tax is imposed under 372-185, and it's imposed on the out-of-state purchase of tangible personal property subsequently used in the state of Nevada, driving of the state and used. However, there is a couple of presumptions that were designed to help the taxing authorities and the taxpayers determine whether or not use tax is actually owed on the tangible personal property they have acquired and brought into the state. And the first presumption, 272-255, indicates that tangible personal property which is purchased outside the state and subsequently brought into the state is presumed to have been purchased for storage, use, or consumption in the state of Nevada. And that would be the key fact that would subject the tangible personal property to a use tax under 372-185. That statute, the presumption statute, contains three exceptions. The first exception is, unless the countervailing presumption in 372-258 subsection 1 applies, then the presumption in 372-255 applies. And then in the latter statute, there are two exceptions. One would be if the purchaser and the vendor sign an agreement or a statement that says that the tangible personal property was not purchased for storage, use, or consumption in Nevada, and that is retained by the vendor, followed by, of course, the facts that it wasn't, then that's that presumption. And the second one would be if the taxpayer presents sufficient evidence to the department to rebut the presumption that it was purchased for storage, use, or consumption. And so that would require some evidence that the taxpayer was not buying it and did not use it for storage, use, and consumption in Nevada. So what we're focused on in this case, and what refund claims are focused on, is the applicability of 372-258, subsection 1, the countervailing presumption. And that was passed in 1999 by the Nevada legislature. It's kind of an odd thing. However, what it does is it sets up a presumption that if a taxpayer meets three factual predicates, basic facts, establishes the existence of these three basic facts, then the presumption arises that the tangible personal property used in the transportation of passengers and freight in interstate commerce was not purchased for storage, use, or consumption in Nevada, even though that property may have come to Nevada for a portion of the time. And so the three factual predicates then that Harrier's was set out to prove by their submissions to the administrative law judge was number one, that the four aircraft were all purchased outside the state of Nevada. Number two, that the four aircraft were used solely and continuously in interstate commerce by the taxpayer, in this case, Harrah's Operating Company. And three, that they continued to use, the first use of the property in interstate commerce took place outside of Nevada by the taxpayer. And then the third one is that that use was continuous in interstate commerce for a period of at least 12 months after being first placed into use in interstate commerce. So it makes that kind of an odd presumption from a tax administration standpoint, because you've got a taxpayer buying the aircraft, in this case in June of 2006, and you have to wait 1 year before they can claim the benefit of the presumption. So Harrah's did the prudent thing, paid the tax, and the month in which they acquired the aircraft, and then accumulated the data to submit their refund claim more than 12 months later, because they had to wait that 12-month period in order to prove that it was used continuously in interstate commerce for that period of time. Nevertheless, that's what the legislature passed, and that's what we're dealing with in this case. Under the stipulated facts, then, we have an agreement by all the parties, including the municipal law judge, that the four aircraft were each purchased outside the state of Nevada, and the purchase contracts were submitted in the evidence. Pilot logs were submitted in the evidence, and indeed that was not in dispute. The second factual predicate was first use in interstate commerce outside the state of Nevada. Harrah's position is, as long as they commence using the aircraft in interstate commerce at a point outside the state of Nevada, that meets that factual predicate of the presumption. Minister of Law judge, looking at the same statutory language, construed that requirement to mean that there is some sort of a temporary requirement that the aircraft cannot enter the state of Nevada during its first functioning use. The problem with the Minister of Law judge's construction of the statute is that the statute doesn't say that. It simply says the first functional use of the, in this case, aircraft has to be outside of the state of Nevada. It has to commence outside the state of Nevada. The administrative law judge's construction appears to be an excessively narrow construction of the statute, which doesn't have any textual support in the statute. In addition, it doesn't appear that the legislature intended the term first use to include some kind of a temporary requirement that a beginning and ending use of the tangible personal property take place entirely outside the state of Nevada before entering the state of Nevada. That interpretation also creates some confusion and ambiguity in taxpayers trying to figure out how this statute applies. And in the administration by the Department of Taxation, because no guidance has been given to taxpayers in the form of a regulation or any other publication as to this temporary use that the Minister of Law judge came up in his construction of that portion of the statute. One of the problems would be, when is the first functional use over with? How is one supposed to determine that in the case of an airplane that's going to be flying back and forth throughout its useful life by the taxpayer? And in this particular case, the Minister of Law judge appears to have drawn the conclusion that at least on the first day of use, it can't appear in Nevada, because one of the aircraft at issue was delivered in Portland, Oregon. It was flown with passengers to Santa Rosa, California, and then it went on the same day to Las Vegas, Nevada. Mr. Abadjo says that last leg disqualified it as a first use outside the state of Nevada. Well, one should say that in the statute, it doesn't. What would have happened if the plane had flown to Santa Rosa, spent the night there, and then flew to Las Vegas? And according to the Department of Taxation and Revenue, that would have been insufficient as well, because it's, according to them, the same journey. Of course, they were assuming all of that. So our argument would be, you want to look at the plain language of the statute. To the extent you can argue that the language on first use is ambiguous as to what the legislature meant by first use, you can look at the legislative history, which really doesn't discuss it in any great detail. However, some of the examples given by the attorney that was the proponent of this legislation included an example of an interstate bus company. And I know about this case because I litigated this case with Mr. Bancroft. He was representing the taxpayer and I was representing the state at the time. And we were talking about tour buses that would pick up passengers in California and drive them through Nevada on a tour and then go back to California. His example would be that that meets the requirements of statute because the first use commenced in California, even though the bus took a route through Nevada and then back to California. So our position would be that this court should reject that interpretation of the administrative law judge as not being supported by the text, nor by reason and common sense on how this statute should appropriately be interpreted and applied. It just injects too much confusion and ambiguity into how the statute applies. And then the final factual problem has to do with the continuing to use of interstate commerce for 12 months.
Well, before we get to that one, I'm a little unclear on how you would interpret subparagraph A.
Certainly. Well, how I think about the first use requirement?
Yes.
First use is as long as the taxpayer began to use the tangible personal property for the use for which it was purchased, commencing at a point outside the state, and that meets that factual criteria.
So your interpretation is that where the plane is delivered doesn't matter.
As it doesn't matter because it has to meet the first factual problem of being delivered outside the state.
Right. But you would attach to the meaning of subparagraph A essentially the origin of the use has
right.
to be
where it commenced.
Where it commences is how you would apply subparagraph A.
That's correct.
So as long as the origin is outside the state, then that satisfies subparagraph A.
But
even if the end point of the flight or the end point of the bus trip is in Nevada, where the taxpayer is located.
That's correct, because remember you have the continuous use requirement too. So the first trip, if you will, using the transportation property has to be the first of a continuum of trips in interstate commerce, lasting 12 months. So that's how you test the first use aspect of it. For example, if tangible personal property was acquired outside the state and the taxpayer was uncertain where that property was going to be used, it might be used for an interstate route, it might be used for an intrastate route, and they haven't decided yet, and they're going into Nevada before they start its use and decide which, how they're going to use it, then you might have an issue with the first use argument.
The concern I have, Mr. Barnum, I wanted to just test your approach here, is that don't the words, a textual evaluation of this, don't the words outside this state in subparagraph A qualify the definition of interstate or foreign commerce used later in the statute in 2A?
2A provides a definition.
Right. And that definition would, I know there's a squabble about that too, but that definition would seem to allow for flights that include flights in Nevada.
That's correct.
So if that's the case, don't the words outside this state in subparagraph A require that that first use be entirely outside of the state?
I don't believe so, because if that was what the legislature intended, they would have provided language that said that. They didn't provide language that said that, so you can,
right.
You can make the equal, you can draw the alternative conclusion, rather, that not specifying that, it could just as easily have meant that the first use of interstate commerce could have passed through Nevada. Because they're certainly contemplating it happening at some point in time in that 12-month period. Otherwise, you don't need the statutory presumption. The property's never here, then it's obviously not going to be something to use that. So the whole statute contemplates that this transportation property is going to come into the state of Nevada at some point in time during that 12-month period. And it may come in regularly. There may be a regular route that airplane is used for. That's where it is to Memphis, Tennessee, where Harris had their headquarters for part of the time. That could have been the contemplation of Harris to use that plane, one of those planes specifically for that purpose. And under the interpretation that you're suggesting, in order to get the benefit of the presumption, Harris has got to send that plane somewhere else first before it comes to Nevada. And the statute doesn't say where it has to go, or how long it has to be outside the state, or any of that sort of stuff. In California, this brings to mind a statute in California that dealing with recreation vehicles, which has gotten Nevada into a lot of trouble. In California, the legislature created a special rule where you can purchase an RV in California, and you're a California resident, drive it, and have it delivered to you in Nevada, sign a little slip that you've taken delivery in Nevada, and as long as you keep that RV outside the state of California for the law varied between 6 months and 12 months, and then bring it back to California and don't have any use tax on it. Okay? But that rule specifies you have to keep the property outside the state for X amount of time. Okay? The Nevada legislature could have done the very same thing if their intent was, as long as you keep that aircraft outside the state of Nevada in interstate commerce before it ever comes in for some temporal amount of time, 30 days, 60 days, whatever, then that's clear. But the statute writing doesn't require that.
Why didn't they do that in use of the words first use?
I don't know why they didn't use that, because my landlord is after the statute, and he had the best case in his mind where buses were delivered to the taxpayer, and then driven on a route that went from California to Nevada back to California. He was drafting the statute, and he said this in his testimony, based on his experience in litigating these cases with me, mostly. And that's why he drafted it that way. So he didn't have a temporal requirement in his mind. He had these examples of real cases.
Okay.
I seem to run out of time as usual. I might get a little bit of time for a rebuttal, if that's okay.
You're out of time, but I'll allow you additional 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is the Court, David Pope, Senior Deputy Attorney General on behalf of the Department of Taxation. This case, the outcome of this case is determined by the plain language of the statute. In fact, the ALJ's decision was based on the plain language, and the Nevada Tax Commission and the District Court agreed with that decision. Contrary to Harrell's assertions, the stipulation facts and the documentary evidence do not provide the basic facts necessary to trigger the presumption in NRS 372-258. Consider the requirement to be used continuously in interstate commerce. The ALJ limited his interpretation to the plain language of the statute when he concluded that the statutory definition of interstate commerce requires the transportation of passengers or property between different points. In addition, the statute requires continuous transportation of passengers or property, so the ALJ also appropriately concluded that each segment of transportation must have passengers or property. Now, if you consider the stipulation of facts, which with regard to all four aircraft, says that the planes were used as shown on the flight logs. The flight logs for all four planes indicate that many flights were made without passengers. In addition, there's no evidence to establish that any of the flights carried property. Stipulation of facts then address it. The flight logs do not address it, and Harris had the burden. They had the burden to bring forth the basic facts to prove that the presumption applied. So the ALJ's finding that none of these planes were used continuously in interstate commerce is supported by substantial evidence. Next, considering the requirement to be first used in interstate commerce outside of Nevada.
So you're reading of subsection B of the statute would say that the owner of the plane flies from Las Vegas back to Memphis empty for the purpose of having the repairs done in Memphis. And that one flight disqualifies the plane from continuous use under the statute.
Correct, because we're limited to the plain language of the statute, which requires continuous use in interstate commerce, the definition of interstate commerce requiring passengers or property between two points. So each segment has to have passengers or property pursuant to the statutory language.
So even if it were flying to Memphis to pick up passengers to fly to District of Columbia, you're saying that's a violation as well?
Correct. That's a limitation of the plain language in the statute.
And you don't think that does that make sense at all?
It's the plain language, and we're limited to that. And
you're talking about section 1, subsection B, correct?
Correct.
Use continuously in interstate or foreign commerce, and not exclusively in the state. For at least 12 months. I'm struggling with that. I mean, how do you efficiently use an airplane if you can't send it back to one location to pick up passengers to send them to another?
Well, Mr. Bowen has already brought up the legislative history. In the legislative history, the discussions were focused on commercial airlines, tour bus companies, and rail car companies. And if you think about commercial airline, the flights always have people on them. They're more adaptable to this test. They're more likely to meet this test because the planes always have people on them. They're flying. They have passengers or property from point to point, and.
So in other words, all they would have to do is put a seat sitter in when they have to go back to pick up a passenger in Memphis that they want to take to District of Columbia, so they get seat sitters.
Well, that's the absurd result. I mean,
it is absurd that
they could even have napkins on these planes, and that might qualify as property, but we don't have those stacks in this case. And for some reason, the legislature wanted to limit this definition of interstate commerce to continuous use requiring passengers or property. That's clear. And we're limited to that language. With regard to the requirement to be continuously used in the interstate,
paragraph 16 in the ALJ's decision, I think I've got the right one here, I think it's record 132, talks about the fact that the flight logs are absent with respect the flight logs. Detail numerous instances where each of the planes flew without passengers, but I don't think there's any determination about property, is there?
Well,
it says in the next sentence, the stipulation of facts offers no explanation for the purposes of these flights, so I guess he inferred that it didn't transport property, but...
That's correct, Your Honor. The ALJ noted that there was no evidence, there were no facts of property being transported on any of the flights.
My impression, I could be wrong, but my impression was that part of the problem, though, on this appeal was that the ALJ didn't even consider whether the presumption applied.
Your Honor, I believe he had a two-step decision. I believe he considered whether the presumption applied, and he stated, using the plain language of the statute, that these planes were not used continuously in interstate commerce and that they weren't first used in interstate commerce outside of Nevada. And then I believe he got past the presumptions when he stated in his decision that there was sufficient evidence for him to find that the planes were purchased for use in Nevada and used in Nevada because many flights were made to and from Nevada, and that the planes were using Las Vegas as a hub. Now, that those findings are supported by the substantial evidence, which is contained in the flight logs, as well as the evidence that Harris has substantial business operations here. So even if this presumption was triggered, the ALJ got beyond it by saying any of the substantial evidence overcome this presumption.
Mr. Pope, do you agree that 372-258-2A contemplates Nevada being either a destination or an origin point?
I do, Your Honor. Thank you. That is the requirement to be first used in interstate commerce outside of Nevada, and I believe the ALJ again limited himself to the plain language of the statute when he concluded that both the point of origin and the point of destination have to be considered. Remember that the definition requires transportation between two points in order for there to be a use in interstate commerce. So if you consider the first two Falcons that, according to the stipulated facts, were delivered in Little Rock, the stipulation of facts, again, indicates that those planes were used in accordance with the flight box, and they were both flown directly back to Las Vegas. So the point of destination is in Nevada. We can't just, as Harris would like to do, disregard the point of destination for the purposes of saying, hey, you know, our first use in interstate commerce is where this flight originated, because if you disregard the point of destination, you don't meet the requirement to have a use in interstate commerce. So neither of these planes were first used in interstate commerce outside of Nevada. The same thing is true with regard to the Gulfstream. The stipulation of facts indicates that plane was delivered on September 5th, 2006. And Harris has attempted on occasion to back away from the stipulated facts. The ALJ didn't meet them, the commission didn't meet them, and the district court didn't meet them. That plane was put into use on September 5th, 2006, and the ALJ said that's the first possible opportunity for that plane to be used in interstate commerce. And that flight went directly from Long Beach to Las Vegas. So again, the destination is in Nevada. It could not have been first used in interstate commerce outside of Nevada. And finally, we have the third assault Falcon that flew from Portland to Santa Rosa, and from Santa Rosa to Las Vegas. When a lot of planes stopped in Santa Rosa, it could maybe need a fuel. One thing we do know is that the ALJ found that the destination of that flight was in Las Vegas. Now, the ALJ's findings conclusions are closely related to his view of the facts in this situation, and pursuant to the Campbell versus Nevada case cited in the briefing, those conclusions are entitled to deference. Should this court disagree with the ALJ here, this plane like the other three, was not used continuously in interstate commerce, so for another reason, it failed to trigger the presumption. And for those reasons, none of these planes triggered the presumption, and as we've already discussed, the ALJ got beyond that and ruled that even if the presumption was triggered, the substantial evidence overcame the presumption. Because the 372-258 presumption doesn't apply, you can say that the 372-255 presumption applies because the planes were purchased out of state. If the purchase would have occurred here, it would have been a taxable sale, and they were brought here. Final point is that throughout this argument, throughout the case, the department has argued that passenger indicates that transportation should be for a fee. And we believe that's the plain language of that word. The definition of the word can be either for a fee or for not a fee, but the definition goes on to say that it depends upon the context in which the word is used. And in this situation, given the legislative history, the context in which the word passenger is used was with commercial airlines in mind and tour bus companies in mind. Most people pay a fare. No other types of businesses were discussed. And with that, the appeal in this case should be denied, and again, the ALJ's decision should be upheld.
Why wouldn't we include in the context of passenger as Harris does in this case, apparently, it brings gamblers to the state. Why wouldn't we include that? I mean, those gamblers are coming out here, and there is a consideration. Surely, if the apparently get their flight free, but they're coming out here with an expectation that they're going to do business here. Why wouldn't we include that within the definition of passenger?
That situation wasn't mentioned in the legislative history, so if, you know, if this court were to determine that the word passenger is ambiguous and look to the legislative history, the indication that we get from the legislative history is that we were considering commercial airlines and tour bus companies. With the situation that you mentioned, there's no guarantee that that's always going to be the case. Just like there's no guarantee that these planes would never be used for interstate flights. The logs indicate that there were some.
So if the planes brought Jack Daniels from Kentucky, would that fit within the definition?
Not within the plain language of the statute.
It's property.
It's property. If we had facts in this case that indicated that property was being transported, we would have a different situation, but we don't have that, those facts or that evidence in this case. I would say that the word passenger or property, because the word passenger is indicative of transportation for a fee, would require transportation of property for a fee. And so as long as they could demonstrate that there was some fee paid somehow, that would be transportation of the property.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add? You have two additional minutes.
No, thank you.
All right, Mr. Clay. Mr. Barnard, I extended you 2 minutes if you'd like to conclude.
Thanks, Bill. Briefly, the facts in this case were stipulated to by the parties. And in the stipulation of facts, the department stipulated that that once the aircraft are placed in service at a point outside the state, they're used continuously in transportation of passengers. Those would be corporate executives and guests doing interstate flights, and that they were continuously so used ever since. So that's the stipulation of fact. The administrative law judge kind of ignored that and basically said that these flights that are passengers somehow interrupted the continuum. But he did not suggest how these aircraft are being used for a purpose inconsistent with the interstate commerce that they have been using it. So he's speculating based on the facts in the record. In regard to the issue of whether property could be transferred, part of the problem with the statute, Your Honor, is that there's no guidance out there on how the department views the administration of it. So we're left as a taxpayer, we're looking at the statutory language and discerning how do you meet the factual predicates in the absence of any guidance. I think you have to look at the plain language. If there is any ambiguity, you have to research the purpose of the statute, why the legislature passed it, and does your client's use of these aircraft fit within the factual predicates to cause the presumption to arise. What the administrative law judge came up with the denial of refund in this case, in both instances, requires including language in the statute that is not there. There's no language in the statute that says the first function use has to take place entirely outside the state of Nevada. There's no language in the statute that says that passengers and freight have to be carried for hire or for a fare. The statute says what it says. And I think based on the plain language and based on as far as the ambiguous parts, the intent of the legislature, the legislative history, and reasoning common sense, our interpretation of the statute and its application to the stipulated facts warrants granting a refund in this case. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Barnard, Mr. Bell, thank you for your arguments here today. We appreciate it and your briefs. This matter will stand submitted.